Not all monsters are myths.
Michigan Monsters.
This is Michigan Monsters. A true crime gothic.
Hey there. Welcome to Michigan, where the lakes are salt-free, the monsters are human, and the tea is piping hot. I'm Jen Carpenter, and today we're going to do something a little bit different. We have been together a long time now, you and I. It's been over 7 years since the podcast came out. Most little indie podcasts don't last this long. There have been over 100 full-length episodes now. That is a lot of Michigan history, not to say anything of the little side quests, right? The mini episodes, the bonus episodes, the mini series, all that stuff. We have talked about a lot of shit. And so I thought that today it would be fun to kind of revisit some of that, because some of these stories we talked about 7 years ago, and there have been updates, some pretty big updates in some of these cases. And so I thought it would be nice to do an episode where we're kind of revisiting all of that, where we're talking about cases that have had updates, but also where I share some life updates with you guys. Not boring ones, don't worry, just the juicy ones. Because I used to do that a lot, right? I used to kind of tell a personal story at the end of every episode, and Jesus God. Okay, I'm just going to get this out of the way right now. If it sounds like my house is caving in around me, or like there are construction workers here in the room with us, that is because this wind is crazy today. The weather, just all of 2026 has been crazy, but today, wild, wild. And I turn off my furnace, I turn off my fans, I unplug my mini fridge. Like, I make sure there is no background noise when I sit down to record, but I can't do anything about Mother Nature. So if you hear banging in the background, that is just the wind trying to bring my house down. Don't worry about it. I'm sure it'll be fine. Anyway, as I was saying, I used to share with you guys a lot of personal stories, and I didn't really do that the last season, and then I was gone for 2 years. So I have a whole lot of stories that I want to tell you guys. So I thought what we'd do today is kind of go back and forth between those two things. I'll give you an update on a case that was covered on the podcast, and then I'll give you a little fun, well, they're not all fun. Some of them are kind of awful, but I'll give you a little personal story and just kind of go back and forth for a little while until we're all caught up. That sound okay? And also, if this is your first time joining us, if this is the very first episode of Michigan Monsters that you're listening to, this probably is not the one to start with, because a lot of what is talked about will not make sense to you. There are, again, over 100 episodes to choose from. I would say pick a different one for your first one, because this one's going to be kind of all over the place. But if you've been here for a while, especially those of you that have been here since the very beginning, way back in 2019, this one is for you guys. All right, so the very first episode of the podcast, way back when it was called So Dead, the very first episode was called Rivalry, and it was a Michigan State University serial killer and a University of Michigan serial killer. Danny and I each told a story. I talked about H.H. Holmes, who is kind of known as the first official serial killer in the United States. And she talked about Don Miller. And this is so funny to me, because one of our goals when we started this, like, we both are huge listeners of true crime podcasts, and we would get frustrated because we knew these cases and we knew the details, and we would get so frustrated hearing the podcasters get stuff wrong. And so we were, what a lofty goal. We weren't going to get the shit wrong. Like, we were going to be so detailed. We were going to get everything right. I know now that that is a fool's game, especially when I'm finding these weird, obscure cases, because old newspapers didn't care about real facts. They just cared if things were like fact adjacent. And so there was a lot of misinformation, names spelled differently from here to there, different birthdays, all that kind of stuff. So it's impossible. Take it easy on your true crime podcasters, is what I'm saying to you, because it's impossible to get all the facts right, because even the official sources don't have all the facts right all the time. But We were so set that that's what we were doing. And then in the very first episode, we said Don Miller's name wrong the whole time. So we were calling him Donald Eugene Miller, and his middle name is not Eugene. His middle name is Gene. That might not seem like a big deal to you, but it has bothered me for the past 7 years because we found out really quickly, like pretty soon after we did the episode, we found out we had made that mistake and we were just stuck with it. So yes, I know that it's Donald Gene Miller, not Donald Eugene Miller. And yes, it has kept me up at night more than once. But as far as the update in the case, it's 2026. When I started talking about Don Miller, that was way back when I started doing the Demented Mitten Tours in 2016. So that's 10 years ago now. And 2031 felt very far away. May 5th, 2031 is the day that Don Miller gets out of prison. Okay. He's not, and just to recap, if there is anyone here listening that maybe doesn't remember the name off top of mind, he is our local serial killer here in Lansing/East Lansing. He murdered four women back in the 1970s. He checked all the boxes, right? He was a scout leader. He was a youth pastor. He went to the criminal justice program at MSU. He murdered his fiance when she broke up with him. And then he went on to murder several more women there. Also rejected him and or reminded him of his dead fiance. And he was finally caught when he attacked a couple of teenagers in their home in West Lansing. He is no longer serving any prison time at all for the murders. He should have gotten out decades ago. He is now serving out the remaining days of a sentence for being found with a weapon in his cell. And so he is scheduled to be released in May of 2031. He's only in his 60s right now. I think he'll be like 71, 72, if I remember correctly, when he gets out. And 2031's only, you know, 5 years away at this point. And where do you guys think he's coming? He's coming right back to the Lansing area. So we are not that many years off from having a literal serial killer back in our community. And a thing that I heard about him, I don't know if this is true or not. I hear a lot of stories from people who knew people that have had to deal with him over the years in different capacities while he's been in the prison system. But I've heard that he is not allowed to be alone. And maybe this is universal. Again, I don't know how prisons work. But I've heard that he specifically is not allowed to be alone with any women. So whether it's a doctor, a guard, a therapist, anything like that. If there is a woman in the room, there have to be at least two armed guards because he is still so hostile towards women. Again, I don't know if that's true. It's just a thing that I was told by a pretty reliable source, but who knows if what they were given was exactly accurate. I don't know. But so that's a thing. This guy that is potentially so hostile towards women and so dangerous that he can't be alone with them is about to be allowed back into our community here in Lansing in 5 years, if not sooner, because he does have one more parole hearing coming up, and that is next year in August of 2027. He's up for parole. He's been up for parole a million times, and he gets denied every time. But even if they deny him next year, he will be out for good in 2031, and that is fucking terrifying. Another little update that I do want to give on that, though, and this one's kind of a good news thing. So he, due to the plea deal that he took back when he confessed to the crimes, he was actually up for parole the first time less than 10 years after these murders. And then he was up for parole, I think, almost every year since. That's kind of the thing. He was eligible for parole, so they reviewed him for parole every year. So his victims, the victims of the women he murdered and his living victims who were children when he attacked them, they have had no peace. They have had absolutely no peace because every year they are telling their story. They are having to go to the parole board. They are fighting to keep this monster behind bars. And so inspired by very heavily what his victims have gone through. Back in 2022, Governor Whitmer signed House Bills 4562 and 4563, which allow the Michigan Parole Board to deny parole for violent criminals for up to 5 years instead of them being up for parole every year. So those bills were passed in May of 2022. And then when Don Miller was up for parole in June of 2022, he was denied. And they said, don't come back here next year. 5 years. We're not looking at your shit again for 5 years. And that's next year. Again, always possible. Anything could happen. Stranger things have happened. He could get parole. But even if he doesn't, he'll be back on the streets in 2031. If you want to have like a big deep dive into the Don Miller case, highly recommend Rod Sadler's book, Killing Women. I do, of course, sell it at Deadtime Stories. Otherwise, you can buy it from your local independent bookstore. But that is a good one to read if you want a really deep dive into that case. Okay, on to a gen update. Biggest question that I get that I don't get it as much now that the podcast is back, but man, if I had a dime for every time someone came into the store or sent me an email or a message asking me where I was and where the podcast was and when it was coming back, I could have taken a nice little vacation for sure. So, and I do, people do still ask sometimes, you know, where have you been? Why'd you take such a long break? What made you decide to bring the show back now? So I'll kind of address all of that because it's all one story. There were a lot of factors, right? And the most simple is I was just burnt out. I'm still burnt out. I just realized that that's never going to change. But I missed doing this enough that I wanted to get back to it. I was having some pretty bad health stuff. I had COVID in 2022 and 2023. But when I got it in 2023, I had like the long COVID stuff kind of kick in. And I still, to this day, deal with what feels like early onset dementia, but is allegedly just a long COVID brain fog. And so it was very hard for me to sit down and focus and do like the very in-depth research and writing and all of that that goes into the show. And it's still hard for me. I'm not going to lie to you. I missed it so much. And I took my time writing out that first episode, right? Because you guys didn't know I was coming back, but I did. And so that I took several months to research and write. But now that I'm on this every other week schedule, I am finding it difficult to kind of get everything done and around in time, just because my brain doesn't work the way that it used to. Another factor was safety. So when Danny and I started the podcast, nobody knew who we were. We made jokes all the time that nobody was going to listen except our moms. We didn't really expect things to take the route they took. And even when it got to the point where, you know, we would get recognized in public and we would do live shows and we had fans, which is still such a weird thing. It's so weird to me. Like, that's just, we just never anticipated that. We were still fairly anonymous, right? Like, you might run into us at the Myers, but, you know, unless you were really intent on finding us, we were somewhat anonymous. And that's not the case for me anymore. When I open Dead Time Stories, I'm just a sitting duck, right? You know where to find me. All you have to do is come into the bookstore and there's a, well, I haven't been there as much these past few weeks, but there's a very good chance that you'll run into me at the bookstore because I am very often the one that is working. And so I started to feel very vulnerable because I had more than a handful of unpleasant situations. One with like a legit like kind of stalker thing going down with a guy who was like sending really, you know, men, just sending really inappropriate messages, making me uncomfortable, not taking my, like, even when I said, if you don't stop contacting me, I'm going to call the police type stuff. Our security on the lookout for him, always at the festival, like just a very uncomfortable situation. And then I have been approached also many times about the specific episodes that I've done. And I've never had a negative interaction with a family member of a victim. that is something that I would take so seriously. It's always the family members of the fucking criminals, of the murderers, right? Their cousins, their best friends, their god sisters, their children messaging me like, how dare you say these things about my parent because they're a piece of shit who killed someone and I'm sorry that that's your reality, but I'm not gonna hold my tongue about the things that your family member did because it makes you uncomfortable, whether they were prosecuted for it or not. So there are a few in particular come to mind, but more and more. And people were coming into the store. I'll never forget this one time. A woman came into the store. Thank God, or more terrifyingly, I was there alone. So nobody else heard this or saw this. But she walked in the door and she goes, I hate you so fucking much. First thing out of her mouth. I hate you so fucking much. And she was upset. Because I had done an episode that just mentioned that he wasn't even the focus of the episode. It was just kind of one piece of the story. A friend of hers who is a serial rapist was convicted on DNA evidence and is serving life in prison for it. And she didn't like me talking about it and came into my store to tell me. And so very much I started to feel very like violated and very unsafe. And that hasn't changed. I just kind of deal with it a little better now than I did back then. But that played a big role into why I decided to take a break. I thought if I kind of disappeared into the background for a while, people would forget about me and I wouldn't have to deal with stuff like that. But, you know, I still have to be public facing for the store. And yeah, that whole thing didn't work. So that was another factor. But as far as coming back and what made me bring the show back, I just missed it. Like the recording and the publishing and the social media, the pieces that make the money, right? The finished product of the podcast, that's my least favorite part. I love the research. I love the writing. I love finding these stories that have been forgotten and like digging up old newspaper articles and piecing this and that together. In a former life, I was going to be a journalist, like no question. And I started going to journalism school and everything, and then life had different plans for me. And so I just really, really missed it. But also, I feel that there is less pressure now. So Danny and I started the show when true crime podcasts were hot, hot, hot. And it was all people like us. It was just people with microphones hooked up to their computers, sitting in their living room, talking shit. And some of those just captured lightning in a bottle, right? And got really popular. And those people are like super famous now and like very well known in the true crime community. And others fizzled out after a few episodes or a couple of seasons. And we were somewhere right in the middle. You know, I was on an episode of 2020 and we've got millions of downloads and fans and live shows and doing really well, but we weren't morbid, right? We weren't morbid. We weren't crime junkie. We weren't any of that. And so there was this pressure of like, we're working so hard. I'm working so hard and I'm just not making it like everyone else. And that pressure's gone now because the podcasting world has changed so much. If you look at the top podcasting charts, that world has been invaded by celebrities. And there are those few strongholds, the morbids and the crime junkies and the My Favorite Murder, that hang on to their fame and their good fortune in that world. Some of them very well deserved, others not so much, but we won't get into that. But there are a few of those. But for the most part, if you look at the top of the podcast charts, it's all celebrities now. Celebrities have taken over that world. And so there's no pressure because there's like no chance. Podcasting is kind of seen its heyday, I feel like. And so the people that are still doing it are either the celebrities that are, you know, topping the charts, the people that found fame in it early on and have to keep pushing whether they want to or not, and the people that are just doing it because they love it, you know, more of a hobby than anything else. And that's how this started. And that's what it is again now. It's just, I do it because I love it. I do it because I think the stories that I'm telling are important, and I don't think there's ever a chance you'll see me on the Apple charts again, because or on 2020 again, probably, honestly. But yeah, so that's the reason, is because it just feels like a very doable thing now, where it got so big and so competitive and kind of this feeling of being left behind before, and I don't feel that way anymore. So yeah, I hope that makes some sense without sounding too weird. Anyway, I've been rambling way too long, so let's get back into some updates. Episode 5, the Kehoe Connection, was back in the very first season when it was Danny and I together. We tried to like put stories together with the weirdest connections, right? Like MSU versus U of M serial killer. This one was two really well-known mid-Michigan cases where the killer's last name was Kehoe. And people will tell you they're related. They were not related. She talked about the Bath school bombing and Andrew Kehoe. I talked about the murder of Rose Larner and her killer, John Ortiz Kehoe. So John was Rose Larner's boyfriend. They had broken up. He murdered her at the end of 1993. He was on the run in Mexico for a while. He was arrested, brought back to the country. He was sentenced to life in 1997. But when the murder happened in 1993, he was 20 years old, and I think about 4 months, if we're being exact. And the reason that matters is because on April 10th, 2025, Michigan's Supreme Court found that sentencing people under the age of 21, which he was, barely, but he was, they found that to be unconstitutionally harsh. Sorry, I lost my place there for a second. Unconstitutionally harsh was the term that they used. And so anyone under the age of 21, when they committed the crime that they were sentenced to life without parole for, gets to be resentenced. Anybody in the state of Michigan. That's about 600 inmates that were 18, 19, 20 years old when they were originally sentenced. Not when they were sentenced, I'm sorry. When they originally committed their crime, sentenced to life without parole, and now they get to be resentenced. This includes John Ortiz Kehoe. So I found all of the articles about how he was going to get a resentencing. I didn't ever find anything stating that it had happened or when his court dates were or anything like that. So I don't know what's going on with the case. Just know that in addition to Don Miller coming back into the Lansing area, we may have John Ortiz Kehoe, Rose Larner's murderer, coming back to the Lansing area as well. So, yay! And that's, I have really mixed feelings on it, right? Because, like, not on John Ortiz Kehoe. I have no mixed feelings on that. He's a monster. He should stay where he is for the rest of his life. But the whole argument, they start referring to people under the age of 21 as emerging adults. Like, okay, yeah, legally they're technically adults, but they're not really, like, their brains still aren't fully formed. So why are they held more responsible than someone who's a year younger, for the same reason? Their brain wasn't fully formed just because of what the legal age is, right? Listen, I don't make the laws. I didn't make these decisions. I do agree that a 19 and a 20-year-old mentally, maturity-wise, is not much different than an 18-year-old, TBH. We all know that, especially when we're talking about men. So I get it. I get it. And I think if it's an... Well, I guess if it's a nonviolent crime, they probably haven't been sentenced to life, right? If it's a robbery or like a, you know, I feel like there are cases in which I would say like, yeah, okay, this is the thing that happened. And it makes sense that like he was just a kid when he did it. And so, sure, let's reconsider just tossing him away and throwing away the key, which is what we did, right? But then there are cases like John Ortiz Kehoe. He brutally planned out the murder, carried out the murder, dismembered Rose's body. If, depending on who you're listening to, possibly consumed part of her body. And I just don't think that's redeemable. And I don't think he should get another shot. And I don't think that Rose Larner's family should have to worry about him. Like, all of the progress they've made, all of the peace that they've found, how can you? But like, this is over. This has been done and over for decades. He's in prison. This awful thing happened to their loved one, but the man who did it is gone. And now all of a sudden, there's this chance that he's coming back. So I have really mixed emotions on this law, because like, I could never be a judge. I get it from the one standpoint of, you know, maybe depending on what the crime was, they deserve another shot. But I absolutely hate that all of these families are being re-victimized by having to possibly deal with some of these people getting out of prison, but at the very least going through court dates and just the risk of it again. I don't like that at all. It's kind of gross. So yeah. Next gen update, and this one will be shorter. I am learning how to be an empty nester. All of the kids are out of the house and out on their own in the world doing very different things now, but it was a slow go. And so, you know, COVID hit right when so many of our kids were right at that, like seniors in high school, just out of high school, right at the age where they would go out in the world. And the world was like, absolutely not, lock them in your house for 2 years because everyone's dying. So kind of a weird time for our kids to be trying to start their lives, but they've done it and they're all out of the house. And it's very strange. I was 18 when I had my son. I moved out of my parents' house with a baby. I've never lived a life as an adult without my children with me. So that's a big thing. I don't really, you know, if you know, you know. It's nice in some ways. It's nice in the way that my kids are doing what they're supposed to be doing, right? They're out there in the world. They're figuring out their own way. They didn't go far, so I still see them all the time. I might be a little more neurotic if I didn't. But they're out there making their way in the world like they're supposed to be doing. But it is hard for me because my kids are cool. I like my kids. I liked having them here. So it's just very quiet and very different vibe around here. And I'm still kind of trying to get used to it. But yeah, I have entered my empty nest phase. So that's a thing. All right, the next episode that we're going to talk about an update for was episode 12. It doesn't matter what it was called because I have taken it down. It was, I don't remember what it was called, to be honest with you, but it was the episode in which Danny and I interviewed Billy Jensen. If you're not familiar with Billy Jensen, he was really big in the true crime world. He was an investigative reporter. He really focused on solving cold cases. He helped to solve quite a few cold cases, kind of kickstarted the armchair detective movement, even though he was a legitimate investigator and reporter. He was very close with Michelle McNamara, who wrote I'll Be Gone in the Dark, and he really found his niche and his fame in that early true crime world. And Danny and I got him right at the right time, right? We were surprised when he said yes to an interview. He was already pretty popular, but it was before his book came out. It was before he started his podcast that he did with Paul Holes. And I mean, right before. I think they maybe announced the Murder Squad within a few weeks of that episode coming out. And so we kind of got him right at the end of that. He was a very nice person to us. It was very kind of him to take the time out to talk to us. We really liked him. We really respected him. I sold his book in the store. We have those celebrity prayer candles in the store. We sold candles of him in the store. Like, big, huge Billy Jensen fan. And so it was really, 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 really disappointing when in 2022, allegations of sexual harassment and misconduct started to come out from several women. There was even a Rolling Stone article written about it. And he lost everything. His second book, which was getting ready to come out, I already had it on pre-order. His second book got delayed. He got fired from his podcast. He did wind up going to rehab for alcoholism. And I've seen him here and there since then. I don't think he'll ever get his place back in the true crime world. I just don't think. He was such an advocate and he was such a supporter of women, and he was so outspoken about violence against women, but to find out that he was, I won't go so far as to say a sexual abuser, but doing these things that were highly inappropriate, was really disappointing. And I think that, like, when women allow you into that space as a true in the true crime world, where it specifically revolves around violence against women, and women allow a man into that space as an advocate, and then find out that he's being shady or slimy on the side, I just don't think there's any redeeming that. And so, again, as much of a nice guy as he was to Danny and I, and as much as we supported him prior to all this coming out, it just didn't feel right keeping that episode up. So I actually took that. It's the only one I've ever taken down, episode 12. Yeah. So, and again, he's out there now. I think his book finally came out. You won't see me carrying it in the store. And I don't think he'll ever get his name back in the true crime world, but which is a shame because he was doing good work. But you can't, I mean, you can't be an advocate for violence against women and be perpetrating any sort of violence or sexual misconduct against women. It's crazy. So that was really disappointing and upsetting. But yeah, that's the update there. While we're talking about famous people, the next gen update is I have become obsessed with the idea of moving to Hollywood, especially now that I'm an empty nester. Los Angeles was not a place I ever really wanted to visit. Not my vibe, not my speed. I'm not fancy enough. I'm not rich enough. I'm not cool enough. I'm not young enough. I'm not skinny enough. Like, what would I do in Hollywood, right? Well, I wound up in Hollywood a couple summers ago because my kids went out there for a vacation, and my oldest son had a medical emergency while they were there. And so within 24 hours of them getting there, he had a medical emergency. And so I had to fly out there, and I got out there and kind of got him settled. And I do have to give a shout out. So, like, the main reason I was comfortable with my kids going to LA is because Danny's husband lives out there part time, and he works out there. He's a director, makes movies, as you guys know, and he was out there. And so there was a parent, right? A grown up somewhere nearby. If something awful happened their first night there, he swooped in, was a lifesaver, literally stayed at the hospital with the kids, helped them with everything until I got there. I got there, kind of got them settled. My son got recovered enough and he wanted to enjoy the rest of his vacation, but I wasn't going home without him, right? So then I'm just stuck in Hollywood by myself for like 3 days with no planning. I was overdue for a nail appointment. I hadn't had my hair done in like a year, didn't have any cute clothes. Like, I was there to be there in case my son needed me. And that was it. But also, I could see the Hollywood sign from my hotel room. And like, when am I ever going to be here again? So I did some things. I went and saw the Hollywood Walk of Fame. It is filthy, but I love it. I went and did one of those like open air bus celebrity home tours. And I loved it. And I saw Jason Statham jogging. Be jealous. I know. And Dave, like I said, Danny's husband was out there. So he took me around one day when he had the day off and just kind of driving through the Hollywood Hills and took me to the Hollywood Forever Cemetery so I could see all of that stuff. And that was, again, really kind of him because he'd already just kind of uprooted his whole schedule to help the boys a couple days earlier. And I just fucking loved it. You know how they say, like, oh gosh, it happens in the movies where you like meet the person that you're meant to be with for the rest of your life, and like you see them and you know it instantly, and it's like magic and this like feeling inside of you that just like clicks into place, like, oh yeah, this is it. We all know that's not really how love works, but like that's how it happens in the movies. This happened to me in Hollywood of all places, where again, I am not young enough, skinny enough, rich enough, like cool enough. I don't belong in Hollywood, but oh my God, do I just want to find a little building somewhere out there where I can like live in the back half of it and have my bookstore in the front half of it and just have that be where I do my thing, because I loved it so much. And I've been back once since, and I think about it every day. Yeah, so that leads into our next update, which is the next time that I went to Hollywood, and our next episode, which was episode 18, Infamous, where Danny and I talked about really infamous, you know, Ted Bundy, Jeffrey Dahmer, Charles Manson, and their connections to Michigan. So this second time I went out there, when I went out on purpose this past summer, just for a vacation, not in emergency mode, Danny and I went together and we did a murder tour, and we did one that was specifically about Charles Manson. And we went to the ranch, the Manson Ranch. We saw where the Tate murder house used to be, Sharon Tate's house. The house was torn down. There's a different mansion there now, but we saw where it used to be. We were on Cielo Drive. We saw the LaBianca house. But the coolest thing was Los Angeles is fucking huge, dude, and it has like different cities within cities. So I don't know what this is, neighborhood, village, whatever, but it's called Chatsworth. And this is where Spahn Ranch was, and it's a little town, and there is this place called the Munchbox, and it's a hot dog stand, but it was there in the 60s and 70s. It's been there, I don't know for how long, it's been there for a very long time, and it was Charles Manson's favorite place to go eat. And so there's actually, like, on the wall, he carved his name in, and it says Charlie was here. He used to sit there and eat hot dogs while the girls from the cult were dancing at the strip club across the street. So that was crazy and cool to see. And I recently posted pictures of that on the Facebook page. So moral of the story. Also, I will say, the tour was great. It was in an old, like, funeral limo. I very much was biting my tongue the whole time, trying not to correct the information. That's a problem. So, yeah, but I loved it. It was fun. And Hollywood is where I'm going to retire in the fictional world in which I'll ever get to retire. Okay, so the next case that we're going to talk about, this is a big update, guys. Episode 19, Vanished. Danny did the disappearance of Mary Lands, and I did the disappearance of Kevin Graves. Kevin Graves went missing in July of 2018 from the Electric Forest Festival. His family would go back every year. They took out billboards. They would hand out flyers. They went back to the festival every year. And anytime someone would ask me for years, like, what cold case would I like to see solved, it has always been his. Because I think most of the time, including with the other case talked about in that episode, Mary Lands, she's missing, yes, but we know that her boyfriend killed her and did something with her. That's usually the case, right? Someone can be missing, but we know that they are dead. Someone can be murdered and it's a cold case, but we know who killed them. Kevin Graves, there were so many possibilities, and many of them involved him still possibly being alive. And so that was the one that I would always tell people I wanted to see it solved. And now it is solved-ish. On December 30th, 2024, a woman who owns some property that backs right up to the Double JJ Ranch, which is where the Electric Forest Festival is, she was clearing her land following deer season, and she found human remains. Not just human remains, but next to the bones, because it was just skeletal remains at this point, there was a backpack and a phone. And inside the backpack was Kevin Graves' wallet. So they did do the dental records to confirm that it was him, but they knew it was him. His phone and his wallet were found right next to the body. They don't know what happened to him because of the condition of the remains. They didn't find any, like, overt injuries to the bones. No, you know, bullet holes through bone or anything like that. So they're not sure exactly. His cause of death was listed as undetermined, but they found him. They found him. His family was able to have a funeral for him. They don't have to wonder anymore where he is. I'm sure they will always wonder what happened to him. Given where he was found, it does very much sound like he died pretty quickly after parting with his girlfriend that night, right? Like, the story was him and his girlfriend got into an argument at the festival and he was going to walk back to the tent. One of the theories, and the one that I believed after visiting the ranch a couple months after he went missing, was that he probably got lost, fell, got hurt, possibly overdose, you know, lots of drugs happening out at Electric Forest Festival, and that he was probably in the woods somewhere. And that is exactly where they found him. So Kevin Graves has been found. All right, so the next personal story we're going to do kind of stays in that same vein, right? We're talking about a missing person and this big multi-year search for him back in 2023. So kind of right as I was winding the podcast down, and it was still all very new, so I didn't really feel comfortable talking about it at that time, but our little tiny country community out where we live was the scene of a really massive search for a missing child. My family and I all participated in the searches. It was like living inside a movie. And when I got ready to tell this story and was just trying to reconfirm the dates and everything, I would have told you guys that it lasted a few days. I mean, the sound of the helicopters constantly, constantly circling overhead, the sound of people screaming this little boy's name out from the fields, from every direction. It was a little two-year-old, nonverbal, autistic boy. His name was Jermaine. He lived about a half mile from us, and he snuck out of the house while his babysitter was taking a shower. And I would have told you the search lasted a few days. It was less than 24 hours. And again, it was just a very surreal thing to be in the literal middle of. The news crews everywhere, the drones, the divers, the helicopter, constant, constant, constant. If you didn't hear the helicopter, you knew that they were just refueling it because it was coming right back. And it was such a helpless feeling. Like, we've got so much farmland out here, so much wooded, swampy area. We've got two rivers that crisscross through the area. And yes, this was a little boy, but I think for anyone, if you're looking for you don't realize how big your world is until you're looking for a person that you can't find in it. And this was such like an eye-opening, an awful thing to be kind of stuck right in the middle of. They did find him the next day, about 24 hours after he went missing. And unfortunately, they found him in the river. And the way that we knew before, you know, it made the news or anything like that, we were coming home from looking, and the dive team had just arrived at the swamp, marsh, whatever, right across the street from us. They had just arrived and like started putting on all their gear and getting out their equipment. And then they started packing it all back up. And I looked at my husband and I said, oh, they must have found him. And I was so hopeful, but you could just see, like, you could see it in their postures, right? Because there was a command center and they all had like the walkie-talkies to stay in contact. You could see that it wasn't good news. But yeah, so that was how we found out that they had found him. And then the helicopter stopped and didn't come back. And it was just fucking awful. But I guess the takeaway from that is just that experience of, yeah, you just don't realize how small you are and how big the world is and how many places there are for a person, especially a child, but anyone, to just disappear. And it's a really helpless and awful, awful feeling. And then a week later, almost the exact same thing happened, but this one's crazy. This one's crazy. It happened on the north side of Lansing. Literally, Jermaine went missing on a Monday, October 9th. And this was the following Monday. The following Monday, middle of the night, a woman living on the north side of Lansing calls the police to tell them that her 5-year-old nonverbal autistic son is missing. She said she had put him to bed that Sunday night, locked all the doors, went to bed herself, got up at 4 in the morning to get a glass of water, go to the bathroom, whatever, and the front door was wide open and her son was gone. So she called 911. The police come. They look through the house thinking maybe he really is in the house. He's just hiding somewhere. They don't find him. They start scouring the neighborhood. The news hits. And again, this is a week after the little boy out here by us went missing. And it was just unbelievable. Another little nonverbal autistic toddler missing from his house. Crazy and scary and awful and been so fucking weird. Because he went missing sometime between like 9:30 p.m. and 4 in the morning when his mom found that he was gone. And at 7:30 in the morning, this old man calls the police, and he lives in the neighborhood, and he says, I just saw a news article online about this little boy that's missing, and I think he's in my house. This man said that his girlfriend slash caretaker, 48-year-old Teresa Wolanski, who was much younger than him, came home at 3:30 in the morning, and she was doing at 3:30 in the morning, but walks into the house at 3:30 in the morning with a little boy. And he's like, what the fuck? And she's like, I just found this little boy out wandering the streets. I'm going to take him upstairs and warm him up. And upstairs was not like upstairs. Upstairs was an attic. And in that attic, police said there was drugs, there was guns, there was drug paraphernalia, there was cat shit. It was filthy, dirty, gross. So the man, her boyfriend, whatever, assumed she was going to call the police, right? Like, she found this little boy, she brought him inside, she didn't warm him up and call police. But then the police just kept not coming. And hours are passing, and he's getting more and more uncomfortable. Now, this woman has already gone to jail once for domestic abuse against this man, so I'm sure there was a fear element there. But then when he saw the article about the missing boy online, he's like, I don't know what the fuck is going on, but this little boy has been in our house for 4 hours. She still hasn't called the police. Like, this is not good. And so he called the police. Police went to the house, saved the little boy. She wound up being charged with felony unlawful imprisonment. She pled no contest. She was facing up to 15 years in prison and a $20,000 fine. But then the article about her plea deal said that she was offered a deal to complete a diversionary program. And then if she did that, they would reduce the charge to a misdemeanor. And I haven't seen any other news since then. I wasn't able to find any more recent articles, so I'm not sure what happened. I'm sure she served basically no time. And I don't know what what's the diversionary program? No, don't kidnap babies. It's not fucking finders keepers. Like, what what's the diversion for that? I'm going to guess, because they said she had an issue with drugs and alcohol, that it was probably some sort of substance abuse program. But man, what a weird fucking story, and what a wild thing to have happen like twice in a row in the same general community so close together, just a week apart like that. That was wild. Next episode update, the Sadler special. This one will be quick. So our friend Rod Sadler, retired Eaton County officer. Season one, when we had Danny's wonderful husband doing all of our audio production, we were able to do interviews. This is not something I can do on my own. My recording studio is me sitting in a chair with a USB microphone plugged into my computer, so I can't really do interviews anymore. But we did a lot of them in season one, and one of our favorites was our friend Rod Sadler, retired Eaton County officer. Now he writes true crime novels, all based in Michigan. His first one was To Hell I Must Go, which was about a murder in the 1800s. The Martha Haney, my favorite fucking unhinged ghost, that chopped her mother-in-law's head off and left it on a platter for her husband to find when he came home for lunch. A Slayer Waits, about a double murder in Stockbridge in the 50s, if I recall. And when we interviewed him, his third book was just getting ready to come out, and that one is Killing Women, about Don Miller. And so this is an interesting story. He's had two more books come out since then, and of course he's working on the next one. But after the interview was over, so the way that Danny and I used to record is we recorded a month's worth of episodes at a time. This is when they came out weekly, when we were very ambitious. So we recorded like 4 episodes at a time. And within that block of episodes in which we did our interview with Rod Sadler, we also did our episode on Mackinac Island, in which I think I talked about hauntings on the island, and she talked about Mackinac Island's only unsolved murder, which was the murder of Frances Lacey. So we finish up the interview with Rod. But then we're still just talking to him on the phone, right? And I said, you got to tell me what your next book is, because I was starting a Don Miller project until I found out that you were writing a book. So I don't ever want like our projects to cross paths again. Like, you got to tell me what your book is. And he's like, oh, it's this crazy unsolved murder on Mackinac Island. Her name is Frances Lacey. And Danny and I had literally just got done talking about her in recording that episode. And that was so weird. So weird. So his book After Killing Women was, it's called Grim Paradise, and it's about that murder. And then he had another one come out last year called Depraved Obsession. And that one is about Ronald Lloyd Bailey, who is a serial pedophile that admitted to kidnapping over a dozen young boys during his reign of terror in the 70s, and he killed at least two. At least two. He admitted to two. It's believed there have been more. I haven't read the book yet, so I don't know a ton about that case, but yeah. And then he's working on another one that I'm pretty sure is about a pretty well-known, somewhat local case again. So definitely one to follow. And if you're behind on Rod's book since we last talked about him, he's got a new one coming out every couple few years now, and they're all good. They just keep getting better and better. So the last personal story, I talked about something very local, very close to home that happened that was really traumatic. I have one more, and it happened, it was like 6-7 months after we moved out to the country for it to be quiet, for it to be peaceful. And like, it is, but also when things happen, when bad things happen, they feel so much more personal and they're so much closer to home. So I literally, and so this story, that I never told you guys, because this happened after the podcast went on hiatus, May 18th, 2024, was a Saturday, and I had worked at the shop. I was on my way home from work, and I was getting off the highway, and an ambulance came. We don't see a ton of emergency vehicles out here, and when we do, it's usually fire trucks because there's a barn fire somewhere or a pole barn fire somewhere. But I'm getting off of the highway, and an ambulance with its lights on is behind me. And so I stay sitting at the exit ramp and let them go past me and don't really think anything of that first one, right? I just see that they're going the way that my house is. And of course, given all of the medical trauma that we've gone through with my son and his medical condition, of course, there's a part of me that's like, oh shit, I hope they're not going to my house. But I'm like, no, they would have called me already. Like, I would know, right? So I continue on the drive home. And then there's another ambulance that comes down off the highway that I have to pull over for. And then there's a third one. And I'm like, bro, what the hell is going on? And so then I turn onto the very, very long country road, two-lane, hilly country road that leads to our house. And there's just more and more and more. And they're passing me all these emergency vehicles, cop cars and fire trucks. And I'm like, what is happening? And so I call my husband and I'm like, are all the kids home? Because something happened. Like, the closer I'm getting to home, now I can see all of the lights. And I can tell that they're stopped near the bridge that goes over the Looking Glass River right near our house, like less than a half mile from our house. I have to cross this bridge to get home, and I can already tell I'm not crossing this bridge. There's just emergency, just a sea of red and blue lights. And he's like, yeah, everyone's home except for Austin. And so I hang up on him, call him. He doesn't answer his phone, hang up on him. I'm trying not to panic, call my ex-husband. I'm like, is Austin at your house? He says, yes. I'm like, okay, because something's wrong. I don't know what's happened, but something big is happening right by our house. I just want to make sure all the kids were okay. So once I've located all of my family members and I know they're not involved, I calm down a little. But as I'm getting right to the cemetery, so there's like a cemetery and then a park and then the bridge that goes over the Looking Glass River, and then like 30 seconds later, our fucking house, right? As I'm getting close to the bridge, like, I'm not crossing it. I had to pull over, because so many emergency vehicles are still coming. And I wound up blocked in their, like, I don't, caravan the right word? I wound up blocked in the middle of them. Like, they literally blocked me in because they were pulling up. It was the craziest thing I've ever seen. These emergency vehicles, ambulances especially, they're not even stopping. They are coming to a roll and people are jumping out of them and running. And I'm like, oh fuck, what is going on? Because whatever's going on is happening between where I am and my house. And so, like, is this an active shooter situation? Is it a fucking bomb? Like, what? And at first, my first thought was like someone had jumped off the bridge or was threatening to. But then I realized there was too many ambulances for that. So I'm blocked in by these emergency vehicles. I can't take a detour. I can't go anywhere. They have me boxed in. So I get out of my car. There's a few people standing at the fence of the cemetery. And I walk over. Nobody knows what's going on. So I'm standing there with them. And as we're standing there, we see the ambulances are coming up into the park onto the baseball field one at a time. One ambulance pulls up. It's there for a few seconds and then it fucking takes off. And then the next ambulance in the line is pulling right up. And so it was chaotic and it was scary. It was really scary because we didn't know what was going on. And then as the ambulances started to clear out, we could see the sheets on the ground. I've never seen that before. I've never seen anything like that in my life. And this man came walking out of the group. And when I say, like, they say, like, oh, they look like they'd seen a ghost, right? Like, that's a comment. This man, he was so gray in the face and he looked like he was going to pass out. And one of the people that was standing in the small group of people that kind of, a few of them were neighbors that had just walked out to see what was going on, but a couple of them were like me and were driving and got stuck in this flood of emergency vehicles, and their vehicles were literally trapped in by emergency vehicles. Like, we were not going anywhere. We couldn't go anywhere until some of these vehicles started to clear out. And he knew one of the people that was in this small group of people with me. And I don't remember his name, but they said his name and they were like, what happened? He's like, she just hit him, man. And he was like, what do you mean? And he's like, this fucking lady just plowed through a crowd full of people. There's dead bodies everywhere. I can't, still, it's been almost 2 years. I cannot put into words for you, like, how shocking. Like, I was on my way home from work, dude. Like, and now I'm looking at, like, bodies in the street, and it was insane. It was insane. If you can't tell, I'm still hella traumatized by it. But so what happened, and I'm sure if you're local to this area, you remember it. A woman, a very pregnant, I think she was like 7-8 months pregnant, a pregnant woman, a 35-year-old pregnant woman, her name is Ashley Monroe, was drunk and possibly under the influence of prescription medication that wasn't hers, went flying down this two-lane country road right as an entire family. It was a whole family. It was 16 people. They had been at the park kayaking and they were having like a family reunion at the grandma's house, which is across the street from the park. And so they were leaving the park and they were walking along this two-lane road over the bridge, over the Looking Glass River to get back to the grandma's house. And this fucking lady hit all 16 of them. Two died, but it was a whole big family and then obviously like smaller families within the family. So like moms, dads, their babies, all of it. Everyone was injured to some degree. There were 14 people injured, some of them severely, some of them critically, and two men killed. And yeah, one of the more traumatizing experiences of my life. And so when you talk about like a mass casualty event, that's what this was. And to literally get kind of caught in the middle of it. God forbid I had left work 5 minutes earlier. I could have been the car right behind her, you know, and seen this happen. And I don't think, you know, it made headlines for a minute, but then like, you don't think how this impacts the community. Cause I don't have a different way home. When I had to leave the house the next day, I had to drive right back through it. And the grandma still lives. Oh, I don't know if she still does, but she still did for right after it happened, right across the street from where it happened. And there are still flowers. It's been a couple years almost now, but just one of the most terrifying, like, what is happening moments of my life. And yeah, still rough to even talk about or think about. So while we're on a downer, another story update to talk about. Actually, this one's good. I mean, it's awful, but it's good. So episode 23 of the show was Daddy Dearest. I talked about Gregory Green, who murdered his whole family twice, murdered one family, went to prison, got out of prison, built a new family, murdered that family. And Danny talked about the missing Skelton brothers. That's a pretty notorious case locally. Basically, couple going through a divorce, had three young boys. The boys went to their dad's for Thanksgiving, and mom went to pick them up, and they were nowhere to be found, and they've never been seen since. This happened on Black Friday 2010. John Skelton, their father, maintained that he had put the boys into hiding to keep them away from their mom. Not true, but, and we know that now, and I think we all knew it at the time. But I will say, because this is the part of the story that always gets left out, washed over, glossed over, and I'll talk about it every time because I have no sympathy for these boys' mom. She's a pedophile. She served jail time as a 30-something-year-old married woman with children. She and her husband owned a business. She had teenage daughters. She had a male teenage employee, a 13-year-old boy that she had a sexual relationship with. And went to jail for it. So she's a pedophile. The boy's mom was a pedophile. If this was reversed and it was a dad that had been to jail for being a pedophile with a young girl, there's no way they would have given him custody of his daughters. But they gave this woman custody of her three sons. The dad decided that she was doing things to her sons and put them into hiding in the Amish community. It's not what happened to them. My argument has always been, if the more stable of two parents, if the one you give custody to is a fucking convicted pedophile, then maybe those children shouldn't be with either one of those parents. And if authorities had stepped in and realized that, maybe these three boys would be alive. But they've never been found. Their dad maintained this story. He said they were in hiding. They would reemerge when they were 18 and safe from their mom. All three boys would be in their 20s now. They've still been nowhere to be seen. John Skelton did go to prison for 10 to 15 years for unlawful imprisonment, but he was due to get out in November. In fact, I had this written down as one to revisit after he got out. He was supposed to get out in November of 2025, a couple of weeks before he was supposed to get out. They charged him with three counts of open murder. So at some point last year, their mother was able to have the boys declared dead officially. Again, probably because their dad had said that they would show up, they would pop up once they turned 18, and they're all in their 20s now. So the boys were declared dead right when this fucker thought he was about to get out of prison after serving 15 years. They charged him with three counts of open murder. So he hasn't had his trial yet or his plea deal or whatever the fuck they're going to do. Honestly, love this for him. I love that he got so close. I love that he thought he was getting out and that he got away with it. And then right at the last minute, they charged him with murder. So we'll see what happens with that. I can't imagine he won't be found guilty, but you know, weirder shit has happened, right? So that's a good one. Here's a bad one. In episode 54, 90 Steps, we talked about Marvin Charles Gabrion, who was the only Michigan prisoner on death row. Michigan is not a death penalty state, but if you are convicted of capital murder or a federal crime, you are subject to federal sentencing. And that's what happened here. So if the name doesn't sound familiar with you guys, the case should. It was pretty big when it happened. So Gabrion is likely a serial killer, but he is actually only convicted of two murders. And those were the deaths of Rachel Timmerman and her infant daughter, Shannon, in 1997. Gabrion was actually getting ready to go to trial for raping Rachel, who was a teenager. And 2 days before she was set to testify against him, she disappeared with her infant daughter. They found her body in Manistee National Forest in a swamp. And so because it was a national forest, it was a federal crime. And when he was convicted of her murder, he was sentenced to death. They never did find the body of her baby, but they said that the swamp was so sludgy that they're lucky they even found her body. So, yeah. No loss there. Totally would have been good with him getting firing squad, honestly. Do they do those anymore? They should have done one of those for him. Would have been good with that for him. However, he is no longer on death row. And I have really, kind of like with that law we talked about earlier with the resentencing young offenders, I have really mixed feelings on the death penalty. There are people that I feel like absolutely fucking put them out of their misery, if for no other reason than for the families of the victims to never have to worry about them being freed again under some bullshit law change or whatever the hell, right? But as we know, so many people are wrongfully convicted. So I think that I don't know what I think. I don't even want to get into that one. I think that only in cases where there's just no question, there's no question, no question, no question. Absolutely, there are people that should be put to death. But the death penalty as a whole, I feel like, is too dangerous with the number of people that are wrongfully convicted. So there's that. Anyway, Marvin Charles Gabrion, been sitting on death row since 1997. Right before Christmas in 2024, on December 23rd, President Joe Biden, who is very much against the death penalty, commuted the sentences of almost all of the federal death row inmates. He converted their sentences from death to life without parole. That included Marvin Charles Gabrion. So he is now off of death row and just serving life without parole for the murder of Rachel Timmerman and her baby. And what's crazy is, like, I didn't even see this in the news anywhere, right? I didn't see this in the news anywhere. I only found this out when I was looking it up because it's very similar to a case that we just had happen in Michigan over the holidays. And that was the murder of Rebecca K. Park. So Rebecca was a 22-year-old, very pregnant young woman who went missing up north. Her body was found in the very same national forest that Rachel Timmerman's body was found in, Manistee National Forest. She had been murdered by her fucking trash-ass birth mother and the woman's husband. She'd had her baby cut out of her. They are now facing murder charges. But my thought immediately when I saw that it was Manistee National Forest was, oh, they can charge her with a federal, they can charge them federally. They can give them the death penalty just like they did to Marvin Charles Gabrion. And I went to look it up to like verify the same park, and that was the reason, and just refresh my memory on all of that. And that's how I found out that he got his sentence commuted. So that was my initial hope for them, was that they would face the death penalty. I doubt very much that that's going to be what happens, given that we are not a death penalty state. We've never been a death penalty state. And the one inmate that we've had over the past few decades that was on death row had his fucking sentence commuted anyways. So likely they will just face state charges. But like, it's like they could have. It could. They should. Again, in cases where like we know for sure what happened, I'm not opposed to the death penalty, and I would not be opposed to it for them. Next episode that I have for you is from episode 63, which was Brotherhood. It was about the serial killer siblings from Kalamazoo, Larry and Danny Raines. Larry and Danny Raines are unique in the way that they are the only serial killer siblings in history that didn't work as a team. So like, yeah, siblings have killed together before, but they did it together. This was two totally separate things. Larry Raines was a serial killer, got caught, got arrested, went to prison, and then his brother became a serial killer, got caught, got arrested, went to prison. They're dead. they both died. They were both alive when I recorded the episode about them. A movie actually came out about Larry Raines, starring Jacob E. Lordy plays Larry Raines in the movie. So there's that. It's called He Went That Way. It's kind of a long movie, kind of a weird movie, but I really liked it a lot. Made by someone here from Michigan. Worth a watch, for sure. And it's about a part of the story that I never talked about, which was when Larry kidnapped an ice figure skater and his ice figure skating chimpanzee and made them drive him from Vegas back to Michigan. So Larry Raines died in 2023. His older brother Danny died in 2022. So both of the Raines brothers are now gone. However, Danny, the older brother and the one that only became a serial killer because his brother did it first and then stole his wife, long story, go listen to the episode if you want more on it. Danny had an accomplice, and Danny's accomplice was Brent Koster. Brent Koster was a 15-year-old kid. He had run away from home, didn't really have any family, met Danny in a roundabout way. They became friends. Danny was like his role model. He really looked up to him. Then Danny was like, hey, I killed this lady and it was super fucking fun. Why don't we start killing ladies together? And so they did. They would kidnap teenage girls and drive them out to remote wooded areas and torture, rape, and kill them. And Brent Koster is now a free man. And when I say free, I mean free, free. So I recorded the episode, or I think it was when I was doing the research for the episode, I realized that the episode was going to hit kind of right at the same time that he was getting out of prison. Released the episode anyway. He was paroled back in 2022. Yeah, 2022. Was it 2022 or was it 2021? I don't know. I can't see it in my notes here. 2021, 2022, he's paroled. 2024, he got caught operating an unregulated ride share service. This man got business cards printed up with his fucking name and face on them. I think it was called like Wheels Up or Rides to Go or Wheels to Go or some shit like that. Like, not regulated at all. Under the table rideshare service. This man who used to kidnap women in vehicles and take them out to the country and kill them was operating his own version of Uber. The good news is his parole officer put an end to that shit. The bad news is his parole ended in 2025 in January. So he is just a free man out there in the world, fully out there. And that is something. Listen, I don't want to talk about Brent Koster too much. Number one, because he just lives in Kalamazoo, not that far away. I know he knows who I am because I've gotten in trouble on social media for talking about him. I've gotten strikes on my TikTok account for bullying him, prompting me to get a t-shirt that said, I bully serial killers. What happened to that? I'm not sure. But yeah, okay, yeah. He was 15. He was influenced, whatever. He was still a serial killer. He's still a free man at this point, and that scares the shit out of me. So there is the update there. Good Lord, this episode's getting so long. I might skip a couple of these stories and tell them to you later, my personal ones. I think I'm going to do that because we talked about how I was going to start sharing personal stories again. We talked about that on Facebook, how I kind of wanted to start telling some of my stories again. And I'm going to save these last two, and we're just going to get through the last episode updates because we're pushing an hour and a half at this point. And that is too long for an episode, friends. Okay, so next update that I have for you guys is not really an update, but it's a little bit of an update. It's from episode 73, Shooter, about Everett High School shooter Roger Needham. In the 1970s, shot a couple of kids, killed one of them, injured the other. Roger went on to get a really good education while he was in custody and serving his time. And then when he was 18, he was turned loose on the world, moved out to New York, lives in like a $1 million neighborhood, works as a professor, blah, blah, blah. Update there is that someone messaged me maybe a year or two ago, because his sister was arrested for murdering a man. I believe it was like her boyfriend or her husband. I believe she poisoned him, maybe. And I think it had something to do with an inheritance or money or his will or his social security. I don't remember the details, and I could not find this message anywhere. I just found that, so it's not really a real good solid update because I don't have details to give you guys. But allegedly, Roger Needham's sister also went the route of murdering people. Just a fun fact. All right, couple more. Episode 82, The Triangle. That one was about the Lake Michigan Triangle and all of the really weird things that have happened, all of the ships that have disappeared and people that have disappeared. And probably the weirdest story from that episode was the disappearance of Stephen Kubacki. He was a college student who went like cross-country skiing out on Lake Michigan one day in February of 1978, I think, late 70s. And disappeared. They found his backpack in the middle of the lake. The tracks just stopped. So they assumed he had fallen through the ice somewhere, even though they didn't really see any breaks in the ice. Just gone. Gone, gone, gone. And then over a year later, he reappears on the East Coast, walking out of a field in clothes that he doesn't recognize, his pockets full of bus tickets. He has no idea that he's lost an entire year. He knows who he is. He doesn't know where he is. He doesn't know how he got there. And he doesn't know where he's been for the past year, right? That's freaky. So he did his interview with police, but never like did interviews or would speak about what happened. He went on to become, I think, a psychologist. He got his PhD, went on to become a psychologist. He released a book last year. So he had never talked about what happened until he released this book last year. And I haven't read the book yet. It was on my list, but I was looking for information for you guys so I could kind of tell you the tea. And I'm so fucking disappointed. But basically, it doesn't make sense to me, but according to him, he made the whole thing up. Him and a group of friends were trying to start some underground resistance, some social experiment, and part of that was him disappearing. And so the whole thing was fucking fake. He remembered the whole time. He knew the whole time. He planned and plotted out how he would reemerge. Maybe there's more to it to that. Maybe it's an interesting story. But I read that and was just like, what an asshole. And didn't go any further. So yeah, Stephen Kubacki, disappearance on Lake Michigan, broke his silence and the whole thing was a fucking scam. We're going to do, I've got two more, but we're just going to do one more because, again, we're about to hit the hour and a half mark. And one of these I can do as like one of my weird, crazy gen stories at the end of an episode. So the last update that we'll do today is from the last season of the show, the episode called The Four, about the Morlach quadruplets from Lansing. At the time that I recorded the episode, there was still one quad left, Sarah, the one that led the most normal of the lives of the four girls after all of the horrors that they were put through. She died in July of 2025 at the age of 95. She was the last sister to go, and she had been the last one left for a good 10 years before she passed. So all four of the Morlach quadruplets have now passed on. I talk too much, you guys. So sorry, but that's what you're here for, right? It's a podcast. You're here to listen to me talk. So those are the updates that I have for you guys about episodes that we've covered before. I did skip over a few stories that I wanted to tell you. I will save those to do at the end of other episodes. The last thing I want to talk about real quick is kind of the future of the podcast. I have switched formats to, instead of just being every other Tuesday or every other Wednesday or whatever the fuck day, 1st and 15th of every month is when new episodes of the podcast are coming out. I will still take my break in May and my break in August. I think it's in August. I'll have to look at my schedule. But I'll take a month off in May, a month off, I believe, in August. And then the season will end in November, as it always has, and then pick back up in January/February. I'm timing the releases to go along with my dear buddy Nina's podcast drops, which are also on the 1st and 15th of every month. Nina is the host of Already Gone, as you guys know. That's like a Michigan's OG true crime podcast. So every time I put out a new episode, just know that Nina's also got a new episode out on the same day, and make sure that you're going and listening to hers as well. One thing real quick, don't want to forget this. Nina also has a book that's coming out next week. It is called Unsolved Michigan. We are having her at Dead Time Stories on April 4th from 2 to 4 for a signing. Do prefer that you get the book from us. I'm going to put up pre-orders. By the time this episode comes out, you'll be able to go to the Dead Time Stories website and pre-order the book. You can pick the book up anytime after next week if you want the book to read it before you meet her, or you can wait and come pick it up at the signing. But it's going to be a lot of fun. Love when I get to do a project with Nina. But April 4th, 2 to 4 p.m., Dead Time Stories in Lansing, Nina instead coming to do a signing for her book, Unsolved Michigan. What else did I want to tell you? Oh, I did want to tell you that one of the things that I want to do this season on the podcast is revisit some old stories in different ways. I'm really proud of the podcast, and I'm really proud of everything that we've put out. In the first season, especially when it was Danny and I, there are some stories that we more glossed over than really got into. No more so true than in the episode that we did with our friends from the Girlfriend Happy Hour podcast, because we told you 5 stories in like 45 minutes, right? Missing and cold cases. And we really did like a very surface level view. And so I want to really dig into some more of those and a few others that I think that we could have gotten more in depth with in that first season, especially. So you may hear some familiar stories here this season, but it's just going to be because I really want to do deeper dives into them. As far as the future of the show, I don't know. I'm glad to be back, but it's also already really stressing me out and really more of a struggle than I imagined it being, in the sense that my brain just does not work the way it used to. And I'm also still stuck in the trenches of small business ownership, trying to keep this fucking bookstore running. For those of you that don't follow the bookstore, I did open a second location last summer. It ran for about 6 months before we had to shut it down. We opened it inside the museum where we do the Festival of Oddities. And that just took a lot out of us financially, emotionally, and I have not quite bounced back. So I don't know what the future holds for any of this. I'm here now. I can promise you that if and when the decision is made to end the show, I will tell you guys. I won't just disappear like I did at our big long hiatus that we just had, right? I will tell you guys if the show is getting ready to end. I do love the writing and the research. I do love sharing the stories with you all. I don't love recording and editing and doing the social media side of it. I just still feel so burnt out when it comes to all that. So I'm here now. I've got a ton more stories that I want to talk about. Unfortunately, Michigan has a never-ending well of true crime to draw from. So we're just going to keep going as long as we can go. Next episode of Michigan Monsters comes out on the 1st of April. And I do believe that is going to be the first of the kind of revisits that I was talking about. A case that was mentioned in an earlier episode, but didn't really dive into. And I'm going to jump right in. So we're going to do that. Make sure that you're following the show on all of the socials, Michigan Monsters Podcast on Facebook, on Instagram, on TikTok. I just have a personal, so it's Jen Carpenter, and it's me, the podcast, the bookstore, all my weird pets. I did restart the Patreon, and I did something kind of fun with the benefit tiers and made one for every area code in Michigan. You don't have to do your specific area code. I just thought that was a fun way to list them. There are no current benefits as far as new things. I'm not doing bonus episodes or early release or anything like that right now, but there is the catalog of existing bonus episodes, which I think there's almost 50 of them that you will have access to if you sign up for Patreon. So there's a link to it on the website, which is michiganmonsterspodcast.com. Yeah, I think that's everything, right? Facebook, Instagram, website, Patreon. If you haven't left a review for the show on Spotify or on Apple Podcasts, please do, or on Facebook. That helps with the ratings. It helps get more eyes on these stories that I feel deserve to have more eyes on them, because they're important cases that not a lot of people talk about. Yeah, that's it. We went just over an hour and a half. That's too long. All right, I'm going to wrap it up. I'm Jen Carpenter. I'll see you next time. Until then, remember to keep your doors locked, because not all monsters hide in the dark.